This hearing of the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. And we've got a lot of people who want to testify today, so we're going to move as quickly as we can. And I'd like to start by having Senator Yvonne Prettner-Solon welcome us here.
Thank you, Senator Marty. I'm very pleased to welcome the chair of the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee, Senator John Marty, to Duluth, along with Senator Laurie. And I did see Representative Mike Charleston in the audience, too. And the staff people, Katie Kavanagh and Laura Blumau, who have come up from St. Paul, too. I also want to thank you very much and to welcome you here. I know that you all have very busy lives and you have many other things that you could be doing tonight. But it is, we are very, very grateful that you come out tonight to tell us your stories or to provide support for affordable, accessible health care. I think it is a topic that's at the forefront this year. It will be next year in the legislature. I think it will be in the national scene also. It is something that we all recognize that there is a problem out there and we need a solution. And so I'm not going to speak very long here. I want to hear from you. You're the people that have the stories that will inform us, and I want to welcome you and thank you for being here.
And with that, I want to start by making a couple comments about the purpose of the hearings and some rules, like hoping people can hold their testimony to about 3 or 4 minutes, because we do have a long list of testifiers. Anyway, the Senate Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee is having a number of hearings around the state this year in which we're trying to get public testimony about health care access, affordable health care access. And I think many of you have read, there was a powerful story in the News Tribune yesterday about a young woman who's struggling to get health care and the problems it's causing in her life. That's because businesses are more and more frequently unable to afford health care coverage. Workers whose employers have health care coverage often can't afford the care they need because of exclusions such as dental care, co-payments, deductibles. They're finding it unable, something they can't afford anymore, and workers are unable to get it if their employer doesn't cover them. The people who are the most sick are the ones who are most troubled and most difficult to get coverage for. The sicker you are, the less chance you have of getting health care in our country. And we hear from people who are desperate for medical attention because they can't find health insurance. We have people who have, for everyone who doesn't have insurance, we have sometimes 3 or 4 people who come with stories about how they have health insurance, but that doesn't give them what they need to get the coverage they need. So we've been traveling around the state. There's no part of the state that's immune from this problem. We're listening to hear what the concerns are. It's similar throughout the state in many ways, but the differences in parts of greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities are different, so we want to hear testimony. The Senate Health Committee next session will be taking up health care reform, comprehensive health care reform, and we hope to get the messages you provide us today, along with those we're hearing elsewhere, about what we're going to need to know in order to put together health care reform. That's partly because so often when we talk about health care reform, we oversimplify. 7% of Minnesotans don't have health insurance. And so sometimes if you think that's what the problem is, then the only solution you need is to find a way to cover that 7%. But addressing that 7%, which is critical, does nothing to fix the problem for everybody else who can't afford health care coverage. So we have to find a way to address it for everyone, to address the gaps in coverage, mental health care, prescription drugs, dental care, so many other things. We have to find a way to address the high cost of premiums, everything else that's not fitting into the plan. To give you an idea of some of the things that might be helpful to us as we look at health care reform next session, out at the door I had a list of requirements that I think we should be including. Our committee passed language like this on what health care reform should include. Things such as ensuring all Minnesotans, not 93%, but all Minnesotans have access to high quality health care, and that we try and save money. We bring the cost down, not by denying or delaying or making care more difficult to get, but by making sure we save money through prevention and early intervention, public health, through efficiency and through reduction in bureaucracy. The third requirement, that we cover all necessary care, including all the coverage we currently have through law, mental health care, chemical dependency treatment, prescription drugs, medical equipment, dental care, long-term care, home health care. Requirement that patients be able to choose their own provider. If you're working at a job for 20 years, you switch jobs, your health plan says, oh, you can't go to that doctor anymore. The continuity of care is important. You should be able to choose who provides you with the health care. And it should be funded through premiums or other payments that are based on one's ability to pay. In Minnesota, we have an income tax system that's based on ability to pay. We should fund our health care in a way that if you're low income, if you're sick and struggling to make ends meet, you should be paying less than somebody who's more fortunate. As I mentioned earlier, we also want to, we doubly mentioned this one, the focus on preventive care and early intervention to improve the health of people and to reduce costs. And we can't forget things like making sure there's an adequate number of health care providers. We had testimony in Bemidji about people going 2.5 hours to get a dentist who would cover their health plan. We need to continue Minnesota's leadership, and we are perhaps number one in the nation in medical education, training, research. And we want to make sure that providers are paid a decent level on a timely basis. State of Minnesota, when it pays bills, is way behind many times. But these are requirements that I think and our committee believe that we should include when we address health care reform. So even if you've got health care insurance, we're not saying you're okay. We're going to make sure everybody gets the care they need. I've introduced legislation this year. We got 25 co-authors in the Senate and 32 in the House right now for a Minnesota Health Care Act that is my way of addressing these 9 criteria. But I'm certainly open to any other way that we can address them. I just think we can't forget some of them and say, well, we're doing pretty good because most people have access to some things. But we got to meet all of the requirements. So as you provide your testimony, we're not particularly interested in hearing about problems with one particular provider. The point is we're interested in your general views, what we should know, what problems, the nature of problems you're seeing, the nature of issues that we have to include in our addressing healthcare reform. And as I said, I'd like people to hold their testimony to 3 minutes. We've got a long list of people. We've already signed up. If we have time at the end, we'll take more. But to put in framework where we stand right now, Minnesota is probably, we're far from the top now in terms of life expectancy. We're way down among developed countries in that. We're too high in infant mortality, two of the best measures of public health. So we're not doing the best we could. And yet we're spending a lot of money. Last year in Minnesota, we spent, you may not see this because it doesn't come out of your premiums. It comes out of taxes for Minnesota Care, for medical assistance, for all the public programs. It comes out of your employer paying. It comes out of what you pay. But the total we are spending in our society in Minnesota is over $6,000 for every person, every man, woman, and child in the state, $6,000 now. This year, the estimate is about $6,500, and we're cheaper than the national average. And Switzerland, they're getting close to $5,000 now. And I mentioned Switzerland because they are the second most expensive country in the world. And I happen to think that we could do it a little bit cheaper than we do it now and provide better quality care and cover everything. When people say we can't afford to add everything to the mix, you got to remember, we do cover people in the end. We wait till you have the heart attack and you go to the emergency room, and then we pay the bills. We want to make sure we pay the bills up front so people go to the doctor when they need, and so we do the preventive health up front. So with that, I will. We have a list of people. I'll go down the list as I have them on the list, and we will ask you to, when you come up, please identify yourself, and if you're affiliated with an organization, please mention that as well, and then tell us your story, and to the extent you can, please keep it brief. We really have a lot of people, and we'd like to get all the testimony. So thank you very much, and I'd like to start with County Commissioner Steve O'Neill.
Thank you, Senator Martin.
I was kind of yelling into because I think you got to be real close to it.
Thank you.
Can I take one of these?
Can I have this one? Can you grab one of those?
Thank you, Senator Lori, for your microphone. Great to see you. Well, first of all, thank you, all of you, for coming to Duluth and to St. Louis County and being here. We really appreciate it. I know I really appreciate it. I want to also say that I think I agree with just about everything you said, Senator Marty, and you took about half of my speech. So I'll be well under 4 minutes. But I'm the chair of the St. Louis County Health and Human Services. And every week I get calls, letters, visits from people who are having some kind of health care crisis. Now multiply that times, you know, our several hundred social service workers, because they get them every week as well. You know, as you mentioned, we have only 7% of people who aren't insured right now. But I think, as we know, and I'm sure you'll hear from stories, that we have so many people that are underinsured or they have insurance that they really can't afford. They can't afford to pay the copay. They can't afford to pay for the medicines that their insurance company will contribute to, but it's not enough for them to make their ends meet. So that's part of the crisis, I think, that we're in right now. And I'm pleased, I think we're all pleased that you're here to address this. I was going to cite those statistics from Switzerland and so on, I get those right here from an article in the Journal of American Medical Association. You know, they say themselves that things are really terrible. We're paying more than anybody, and we have really poor insurance compared to the rest of the world. You know, 47th in life expectancy. For those of you who haven't seen Michael Moore's movie Sicko, I would recommend it to everybody. Even if you don't like Michael, and I know several people who don't like him, and they saw it, and they said, he did pretty good this time. We really have got to figure out a new system. And I personally believe a single payer system is a way for us to go. But, you know, I'm sure if you're open to other ideas. I want to just, there was a survey that an ad hoc committee around the state put on, and they looked at counties around the country, around the state. And I want to just highlight the top reasons that people are not getting medical care in St. Louis County. This was put on last summer. 147 people, I can't afford my medical. 84, I have no insurance or medical assistance. 79, my insurance or medical card will not pay for dentists. 80, the doctor, dentist, and clinic would not accept my medical assistance. And over again, that's another problem. I mean, these are folks who have medical assistance. They have some insurance, but they can't find anybody to see them. And that just happens so much, so often. And that's, in fact, I would have to say that's probably the number one complaint that I personally hear from people. They have medical assistance, and they can't find anyone to serve them. And as we know, what people will do if they're sick eventually is they'll go to the emergency room. And as we all know, that is a very expensive, and that's probably one of the reasons we're one of the most expensive places in the world, because we're serving so many people in our emergency rooms. Unfortunately, for people who have dental problems, there is no emergency room in Duluth or in St. Louis County or in northeastern Minnesota if you have a dental emergency. Nobody's going to pull your tooth. Nobody's going to drill out that cavity. And so you have to deal over and over with pain, and I know you're going to have some folks testify about this. I do want to thank Angela Graber, who was in this article that you cited, and I hope everybody got a chance to see it. It's a great article, and I think it really does a good job of both showing her case and how compelling that is. Somebody who's working, making $19,500 a year, they have no health insurance at her job, she can't afford health insurance, and she makes too much. Just a little bit too much, but she makes too much. And I have to say, I get calls regularly from people saying, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to work part-time. I'm going to get another job that pays less so I can get medical assistance. And you know, that's not the productive way we think about our state, our country, and our county. So let me just say in closing that I think that just as Minnesota, and we look at our proud history in this state, has led the country and the world in so many things, in business, in government, in health, in human services, we have been a great leader. We would all acknowledge that, Republicans, Democrats, independents alike. But you know, we've done that. And just recently, I want to thank you for leading Minnesota to be the 19th or 20th state and getting clean indoor air and making all of our workers safe. That's a great thing. We can't wait for this country to do it. They are not going to do it. They are, unfortunately, bought out and controlled by the powers that be. We, as the state of Minnesota, and all of us in St. Louis County want to help you do that. Please lead us into a position of leadership. As you said, Senator Martin, we're not leading the country right now ourselves. And we should be, and we can be, and I hope you will, and I hope that we can be part of that effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Prettner, so on.
Chair Marty, thank you. Commissioner O'Neill, thank you for your testimony, and I'm wondering if you'd be willing to donate that piece of paper to Senator Marty.
I wanted a copy there.
He would like a copy of it. And one of the comments that you made about the difficulties up here and the fact that we now have a 7% rate of uninsured in Minnesota doesn't take into account that northeastern Minnesota has the highest uninsured rate in the state. And I'm afraid I don't remember the exact figure. It's over 9%. I don't know if it's 9.2 or 9.4 or 9.7, but I know it's over 9%. So we have a greater hardship in this area, and that's why it's so very important to hear from the people here.
Thank you. And next one we have on the agenda is Sue Graber.
Stomach,
and no place to go, why not commit a crime? Because then we will give you more reward. Is jail a place that anybody would want to live? The average person, probably not. But you, if you had absolutely nothing, you'd do whatever you could to find it. I fight for my daughter. She would be here right now if she wanted to, but she had already made a commitment. Because when she's not working, she's also working side jobs so she could pay for her medication. I help her as much as I can. But her medication is more than some people's house payments, way more than car payments. So she just can't afford anything. She ends up in tears many times. And I know I'm just speaking on my daughter's behalf, but I know this is a fact with many, many, many people. And I just think it's really important for her to be able to get some help. I think she would be willing to come in and meet with any one of you at another time, as long as we can schedule it. She just said, Mom, let me know, because I would be glad to go, and her and I would come together. So thank you for your time, and I'm glad you read her article, and I hope it makes a good point for everybody.
Thank you, Ms. Graber. And I wanted to tell you that there's a little bit of, it's a temporary fix that would help in your daughter's case, but the legislature in the past year did pass language that a child under 25, not child, but a young adult under 25, even if they're not a full-time student, which they would be covered if they were full-time students until now, but beginning January 1st, until you're 25, you could get coverage under your parents' policy. So your daughter presumably could get recovered by yours. That's not a permanent fix. It's a very poor way of doing it, but at least in your case, it would help.
But see, it doesn't help because I personally don't have insurance anymore.
Okay.
Because of the same situation.
Okay.
I can't have insurance because I myself have epilepsy also. And I can't get insurance through any employer, and I'm caught in the same catch-22. So.
Yes, well, that's why I was saying it's a temporary fix.
Right
now, I hoped it would help in your case.
Carrying it right down in the family. So
yes.
It gets really frustrated, and my daughter keeps being told, nope, you make too much money, you make too much money. Well, I don't consider 19.5 is too much money. So, you know, she's trying to further herself in a lot of areas, but she can't get there. And it's just goes back to the hold the bucket song because it's...
Yeah. Well, your testimony makes the point very clearly.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Senator Prettner, someone.
Ms. Graber, would you also tell your daughter, I think I spoke with her earlier today, and I thought that the laws we passed went into effect in August, but apparently it's in January when our Minnesota Care would go up to 200% of the federal poverty level, which might make her eligible for Minnesota Care now.
Right, because when she told me that information, she had just been denied. She keeps reapplying and keeping denied. And right now she's in the process of, she was just in the hospital last week, very sick, 104 fever. She has over a $2,000 medical bill right now. And she has no idea how she's going to pay. So she's trying to get help through St. Mary's. They will help her with a certain percentage, maybe. But then again, we go with Dom trying to get things paid off. So it's just really frustrating.
And your story, again, that Senator Brittner, Solomon, and myself both saying, well, maybe this will work. I mean, that's the trouble with what we've been doing. It's patchwork. We're going to try and fill in this gap. We're going to try and help her try and do that. Your point about prison inmates is exactly right. The only people in our country, only people in our state who have a constitutional guarantee to health care are prison inmates because they're in public custody. We have to make sure they get quality health care.
Right.
I just think the rest of us deserve the same, and your daughter is certainly one of them.
Exactly. And how many people in this room can actually say that they eat 3 balanced meals a day? Probably not a very high percentage. And I always maybe make it, it's just an off-the-wall statement, but what if we took 1 meal a day away from the prisoners and put that towards health care? They wouldn't be happy, but, you know, it would just be a large amount of money that could be rolled over into helping people that are obeying the law. And that might also be used as an incentive for people to obey the law when things aren't so privileged behind bars.
Close. Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, we have another state guaranteed or mandated plan is MCHUM, Minnesota Health Plan. It's more expensive than Minnesota Care, but it was passed to make sure that people that are denied health insurance have insurance. That's paid by insurance premium tax and subsidized by the state. I don't know if you've checked into that.
We checked into all angles. I was given a sheet from St. Louis County, and we've covered into every single one. There was one that she could actually be working and getting insurance, but she would also have to be claiming Social Security and be unemployed for a year. It's all attached 22. It just keeps ending back to square one. So
why we need comprehensive reform instead of piecemeal. But thank you very much for your testimony, and I wish you and your daughter the best. Sue McClarnon. Sue here. Welcome to the committee.
At least that it must go to health care. And that's, I think, our easiest solution in the state, cover folks and make sure that all of our healthcare tax dollars goes back, because we know that if we can do prevention, clinic, and other outpatient types of care, it will help us on the more expensive ends and reduce it. So I will put my 2 cents in for that. We are continuing to see our ER visits increase across every state, and those are because we're not addressing alcohol issues, mental health issues, and dental and nursing home and other types of payment issues that are then cycling people through our hospitals. And we don't want them in the hospital if we don't need them. And as we have a crisis around beds for hospitals across the country, we can't afford to have people who don't need to be in a hospital in a hospital. Yet we are required, because of our ER and EMTALA laws, to take anybody who walks in the doors, even if they could be shunted to an urgent care. Our bureaucracy makes it very difficult to triage and send them to the proper level of care. So there are lots of creative things going on here in Duluth in particular. So I have been a big supporter of those, and I know more about it. We do, especially I as a Catholic, feel we have a moral obligation to cover all of our folks in here in Minnesota with excellent health care.
Thank you. I had one quick question. When you said people with dental problems showing up in emergency rooms, how often are you seeing, how many?
Every day. We are seeing, and now we have the dental project here, so we'll see over time some help, but because it's been such a long-standing problem. And then our ER physicians can't get them to a dentist because they won't take, or they only take a certain amount in their office.
They can, you can deal with the urgent problem, but the next day you still haven't fixed it.
Right.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Tamika Robinson.
She's not here.
Okay. Kelly Herstad. Is Kelly here?
Yeah.
Kelly.
Right there.
Kelly, yes, please.
I came here with prepared text, but considering what I read here, I'd like to change. I'm a local businessman. We provided health care for my employees for 40 plus years. And about 5 years ago, I came to the conclusion that a little bit longer than that, during the Clinton administration, I developed an acquaintance in the SBA by the name of Jerry Glover, who was the advocacy for the SBA under the Clinton administration. We had a lot of conversations about health care. He made a statement to me that if you took Medicare and you lowered the age to 55 from 65, it covered about 80% of the health care costs in the United States. And he said that Medicare, if you factored in, or cost about 5% to administer, and if you factored in another 5%, it was 9% for fraud. It was 90% effect. And I have had so much difficulty getting affordable health care for my employees, because it can range in cost from $250 a month to as much as $700 a month, depending on age. Somebody who's 60 years or older, it's $700 a month. Somebody who's 20 or 22, it's about $250. How can you not look at employees differently when you have that kind of cost spread? You shouldn't. The law says you shouldn't. You shouldn't discriminate by age, but the insurance companies do. I've been advocating a single-payer system since the time of my discussions with Jerry Glover. Mr. Jaros, over here, Representative Jaros, said that it's taken me a long time to come over his views. The thing that does concern me with this, as I read it, is that you are, I'm sorry, making the mistake that Mrs. Clinton made 13 years ago. She attacked it all or nothing. And the Wall Street Journal today had quite an article on the fact that she learned well. In Iowa today, she's announcing her plan. And it's a piecemeal plan. But you find, and you should know as legislators, that if you're going to carve out a stone, you start by tripping it slowly. You don't hit it with the hammer all at once. And what I see here is right now, you as legislators, have created an oligopoly in the state of Minnesota by the way you have regulated insurance companies. You only have two or three major players. That's an oligopoly. You're creating a monopoly. The state's going to take it over and be the single payer, but you also don't define how you're going to pay for it, other than to say you're going to charge by wealth. What, you're going to take several thousand millionaires and charge 10% of their income, and then 10% of somebody who's on AFDC, well, they don't have AFDC anymore, but assistance. You're going to drive the more affluent people out of the state and leave the people less affluent to pay the bill. They already go on the income tax bracket. Many of my friends spend their winters and have moved to Florida, no income tax. So you've got to be very careful in that respect. Now, I came to Chip Christone today. I had testimony on three issues that affect me greatly in my business. But instead of testifying and wasting everybody's time, I'll give you a copy of that testimony so you can look at the three items. But to me, you're on the right track, but I do believe that you're going to get into something and you're going to find somebody's going to get elected on the national scene that's going to propose a national plan, because we do have a big crisis in this country, and we as employers can't solve it. You as legislators can. But this does scare me from the standpoint of the unanswered questions that I could raise, but I won't in the limited time I have. So please consider that and look at it by an incremental test. Look at the people that aren't insured and how can you get them under the umbrella. Look at the people that are spending money, small business people, and ask them what possibly would get them to drop the plan. And I have three items in here that are small, but they're meaningful to me economically and to my employer.
Thank you, and we will look forward to getting a copy of that testimony. I think your point about the age discrimination, the tendency for an employer to want to say the younger our employees are, the cheaper their health care is going to be, is very real. I mean, an employer can't help but be thinking about that even though they're not allowed to.
That's true. The thing that one of my comments in there is, to me, in the old days, the insurance companies blended the rate. They said so much for the employee, regardless of age, so much for the dependent or the spouse, regardless of age, and so much for each independent. Today, they give me a bill, 22-year-old, 25-year-old, 30-year-old, and so on, and give me the rates. They give me the rates and say, this person is 60 years old, it costs a lot more than the younger one. Now, one of the other things your plan does not address is people who go on Social Security. There's no mention in here of how you're going to blend into Social Security. Right now, if I pull out my Plan A card, and I do this on the Coon Show, this is Type A. This is 65 years of age, ready or not, you're on Social Security, Medicare A. All right, I have two companies, one with 50 employees and one with 15 employees. This card, Medica, with the 15 employees, costs me about $250 a month for me over 65. Two employees of my other company have 50 employees, the same card costs $750. I ask why. In the federal government's wisdom, they make Medicare primary for employers who have employees with less than 20 employees, but with those that have more than 20 employees, Medica becomes first and this becomes second. How are you going to dovetail that in your plan? Didn't make sense, but what it is, it's a political help to the small business person. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, and we'll take a look at that after the hearing. Jennifer Huntley. Thank
you. Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. And as a mature worker who's looking for employment in the Duluth area, I would like not to be on TV, if that's okay. Thank you. There are enough challenges for mature workers to find employment, and I think medical insurance is one of the biggest reasons for that. I can show you a spreadsheet of jobs I've applied for in the last year in this area, and you'd UPS founded, and how difficult a market this is. So, I have a very brief statement. I would like to tell you about an experience. I had a medical emergency about 5 years ago that required emergency surgery in about 4, maybe 5 days of hospital stay. I was lucky, I got good care, I recovered, but the real problems came after I went home. And my insurance policy mandated only $2,000 out-of-pocket expenses. Providers were aggressively pursuing over $5,000. All of my questions, I called everyone, providers, insurance companies, credit collectors, hospitals, attorneys, and social service agencies. No one could help me with the problem. So there was a lack of information, and I do believe that I was charged a different price for the service of the insurance company. So no one could really tell me how much it actually cost. That should be illegal. It was about a year ago I asked how much an x-ray would be, a simple x-ray. No one could give me an answer. They gave me an estimate, and it was over 3 times. It was over 3 times what they estimated. So there's a problem with the information being kept secret about the cost of medical services. So I guess I just would like to say that we need to get that information out there in order to start tackling the problem. That small hospitalization continues to negatively impact me today because my credit rating doesn't look very good. I did pay my bills, but that was another problem with the insurance. Actually, the medical providers shared information with each other that they knew I did not pay my bills. So there was data privacy issues. When the attorneys bought the debts, some of the debts that I kept trying to get the real cost out of the providers, they just shut down my bank account without even going through legal procedures. It was illegal. So it got really interesting for a fairly small medical emergency, and it still impacts my ability to find a job. If an employer looks at my credit rating, they're not interested. So it shouldn't be this tricky. Yeah. I'm really healthy, and I rarely use or need medical services. But boy, one blip, and that was a long-term problem. So I think you're on the right track here. It's not going to be easy. If you need, I certainly have copies of my resume and would love to be part of the solution here. I have a degree in communications. I think it would be a blast to become part of this movement. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Huntley. Senator Lori.
Ms. Huntley, thank you for your testimony. I think that the issue about costs being dependent on who's paying the bills is critical to start getting at and add some transparency to that. And
yes.
Thank you for being willing to come up and share your story.
Thank you, Father Tom Foster. Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
What I share are my observations. I was unable to quickly find the data behind it. I speak as a chaplain at one of our local medical centers and also as a military chaplain. And each of those venues where I serve bring with it different observations. But one thing that I do find is that there is a large portion of our population that is without insurance and find it difficult to afford that insurance. And that would be our younger population between 18 and approximately, let's say, 28. And that has an effect on one of the observations that I've seen at the medical center where I'm the staff chaplain at the birthplace and the neonatal intensive care unit. We're seeing an increased number of young mothers coming to the hospital with no prenatal care, unable to afford insurance, and unable to always find adequate care that would be within their budget. And with the lack of prenatal care, then we are seeing an increased number of those children being born without prenatal care moving into our neonatal intensive care unit. And if you look at the facts of the amount that has been written off by St. Mary's Medical Center, it is an increasing number. And the neonatal intensive care is one area that is rather costly. Also, I have, as a military chaplain, been with some of our members who, again, are unable to afford insurance. Hopefully, after the 1st of October, we will see a great change there, where now traditional Army and Air Guard members will be able to purchase individual and possibly family coverage. But again, what is the cost going to be? You know that insurance tends to be costly. It is not uncommon in my work to spend time with patients who have heard that they have cancer to now be faced with the dilemma of how to pay for it. And in a working in a place where we hold that one of our basic human rights is health care, it becomes a real challenge to help them find ways to pay for their health care. It has not been uncommon for me to spend time with patients who are advancing in age, who are waiting to turn that magical number in their 60s so that they can with joint replacements. And I wonder how many years they would have had a year if that type of pain. And that includes people who have taken great care of their life, but now have found themselves in a life situation where they're in employment that does not offer medical benefits. That is becoming an increasing case scenario that we hear from our patients. They work, but they're not able to afford health care. And then you hear, will your health medical center be able to write it off? When we're already one of the top in the nation, it's hard to continue to look at that as a legitimate avenue for payment. These are some of the observations that I have seen with the RP.
Thank you, Father Foster. A quick question about the, you say the young women who have no prenatal care, are they coming in at the child birth?
Yes.
With none until then whatsoever?
Right, correct.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah, you don't have the statistics, nor do I, but I have a feeling that does lead to a significant increase in the intensive care.
Right. We tried to pull some of those numbers up today. It was kind of like a short notice, but that's a all too common occurrence, unfortunately.
If you do have the ability in the next few days to pull up some of those numbers and could share them with us, I'd appreciate it if you could. We'll get you a card.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next, we have Monica Little.
Midwife, and I am licensed by the state of Minnesota to provide maternity care services for women choosing out-of-hospital birth, and the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice oversees licensure of certified professional midwives in the state since 1999. I believe that me and my profession can be and already are part of the solution. Still, while I am a licensed healthcare professional, there is a lack of access to the care that I provide, which I believe is superior to much obstetric care in the state. Namely, women desiring my care must be able to afford to pay out of pocket for my services, because many, perhaps most, private insurance companies, HMOs, as well as Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance, do not cover services provided by CPMs at this time. There's an exclusion. I spend far more face-to-face time with my patients than most OBs do, an hour each prenatal visit. And I charge a fraction of the cost. Minnesota licensed midwives currently charge on average $2,500 to $3,000 for the entire package of prenatal, home birth, and postpartum care. Hospital costs alone for an unmedicated vaginal birth, which actually is a rare thing. Perhaps less than 10% had an unmedicated vaginal birth in the hospital, is going to cost at least $7,000, and I may be way undershooting this. A cesarean section can cost $20,000 or more. You add the prenatal and postpartum costs to this, and you can see that home birth care, certified professional midwifery care, licensed midwifery care in the state of Minnesota is cost effective. Many women do value the care I provide enough to pay out of pocket. However, for others, the cost is prohibitive. By adding licensed midwifery care to the provider list for Minnesota Care and other state health plans would increase access and affordability. Additionally, doing so would decrease taxpayer costs because midwifery care is proven to be cost effective. There was a study published in the British Medical Journal in 2005 on CPMs. I just want to point out a few results of the study. There were about 5,000 women with planned home births. Only 3.7% of mothers needed a cesarean section. In Duluth, our two hospitals have cesarean rates of 29% and 35%. 35%, which is even higher. Both of those rates are higher than the Minnesota state average, which is still 25% cesarean. Only 2.1% of planned home births needed medical induction. The hospital induction rate in this study was 10 times higher. Furthermore, 90% of women who were planning a home birth were breastfeeding at 6 weeks postpartum, and breastfeeding is unequivocally known to improve infant health. The American Public Health Association supports, quote, increased access to midwifery services and out-of-hospital maternity services through recognition that legally regulated and national certified midwives, that is CPMs, can serve clients desiring safe, planned, out-of-hospital maternity services. Senators, between one-third and one-half of my midwifery clients qualify for Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance. Many more women have asked for my services, but then decline when they discover that their insurance company or their medical assistance will not cover my services, despite the fact that I'm licensed in the state of Minnesota. I'm advocating for access to licensed midwifery services by anyone who chooses such care, and I want to ensure that the Minnesota Health Care Act that I read here tonight, if enacted, will include licensed traditional midwives, and that we may be generously compensated providers. There's a model that I know of, one where I trained in Washington State. The Washington State Basic Health Plan is comparable to the Minnesota Care Plan. And under Washington State law, every licensable health care provider in the state is eligible for reimbursement by all health plans. No licensed provider can be excluded. And this means that every woman has access to the kind of maternity care she chooses, because all maternity care will be affordable. And I urge you, please, to consider doing likewise for Minnesota families. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The bill, as we do have it, would include all licensed professionals. But I think your point about, your most important point about the cost effectiveness and giving people the option for the type of birth they want to do is important. So thank you for your testimony. Ed Gleason. Is Ed here? I guess not. Jessica Crowley, Christine Poost, and Jim Scheffler. You can begin and sit down, sir.
Welcome to the committee.
My name is Jessica Crowley, and I'm from the Superior Community Health Center. I'm a social worker for the Healthcare Access Office. At our health center, what we do is we are able to see people who don't have health insurance based on a sliding scale according to their income and household size. And after hearing a lot of the testimonies that have already been said, I was thinking that one of our biggest jobs in the Healthcare Access Office is piecing together people's health care. We see a lot of people who have Minnesota Care, the limited benefit set, and you know, we sign them up, and they come in and they say, okay, so I need dental care. Well, dental care isn't covered. And then they say, well, I need eyeglasses. Is that covered? No, I'm sorry, that's not covered either. So a lot of what we do is connecting people with community resources to try to help pay for that. One gentleman that I think of in particular is a man who came into my office. He came to our medical clinic because he had a dental abscess, so he was able to see our nurse, get an antibiotic for his tooth, and he actually came in wearing a pair of safety glasses with his one lens left over from his glasses taped inside his safety glasses. And his teeth are lying. At one point, he had gone to the emergency room to get his abscess drained, which is not a pretty image to have in your head. But he had the abscess drained, got a bill from the emergency room for $2,000. I'm thinking, for that $2,000, he could have seen a dentist, gotten his teeth pulled, and been on his way to getting some dentures. But instead, they fixed the problem for like a month until it acts up again. So that's the kind of thing that we see all the time. Another woman that my coworker Christine, who couldn't be here tonight, is dealing with, was the woman had Minnesota Care Limited Benefit set, and she had shoulder surgery in June, and then was ordered to have physical therapy after that. Well, her benefits don't cover physical therapy, so she wasn't able to get the medical care that she needed then. And had to wait in line for, luckily our Lake Superior College here has a physical therapy program where she was able to get on a list, but it was like 2 months down the line until she started her physical therapy after her surgery. So now her recovery process is hindered, and she may have permanent damage due to not being able to receive the care that she needed. Those are just a couple stories, but just being able to have a complete health care plan would make so much difference for people. I think Minnesota Care just, it leaves so many parts out. It's like people can't see to do their job, and people don't have good teeth, you know, to find a job and to keep themselves healthy. We see so many people with heart problems and other problems that are generally affected by everything.
It's kind of bizarre the way we exclude dental care, which does lead to heart disease, and who picked out our eyes and our teeth as things we don't cover instead of our toes or whatever. Yeah,
Chairman.
Senator Brittner-Sowen.
One of the things that the legislature was forced to do back in 2003 was to create this limited benefit set because we did have good coverage. And if we had this current deficit of $4.5 billion and there were no tax increases and it just came in cuts in services. And we have gradually been restoring them. And this year we repealed the limited benefit set. But and we were just talking, I can't remember when it goes into effect, if it's in January or if it's later in the year, next year. Is it July? Okay. So that is being repealed, but it will be allowed.
Scheffler.
Jim Scheffler. I'm actually a social worker in Superior with the Lake Superior Community Health Center. Am I allowed?
No? You're doing well now.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine. So I actually brought a letter that John Herbert, who's a social worker in our Duluth office, put together. I'm just going to leave it with you. There are two examples that are worth reading, but they're details to the Minnesota Care System that you want to be aware of, but probably take more time than you really want to deal with tonight. So let me leave that with you. And the other point that you really wanted to make was a dental again, is the thing we see people coming in, and there aren't the options, and even if they have the GAMC, as you know, finding dentists that will accept them and getting into that whole routine really is a challenge. And so I'm just going to emphasize that for you, and just as another voice in this play here. And we really are an access point for information for you as legislators. So if you need that kind of information, those kind of stories, those kind of examples, we see those people every day. That's our job. So.
Thank you both. And Ms. Crowell, your story of the person getting $2,000 to drain their abscess in an emergency room and yet not fixing anything of the problem, you really say, what kind of a system do we have here? And we had testimony earlier this summer on the Healthcare Access Commission in which one of the people said, if you were trying to design a system for healthcare that didn't work, you couldn't have done a much better job. And that sort of summarizes where we are right now. Thank you both for your testimony. Andy Peterson. Welcome to the committee.
Well, good evening. I'm Andy Peterson. I work for the Duluth Area Chamber of Commerce as their Director of Public Policy. I want to start out by saying that I think our goal should be 100% coverage and that no Minnesotan should go without medical coverage. I'd also like to agree with Commissioner O'Neill in stating that coverage through the emergency room is an ineffective, overpriced, and somewhat ugly option for healthcare. I'd like to compliment Generations of the Lake Superior Community Health Center for doing a hard and difficult job in the face of great adversity. And then lastly, before I get going on my comments, I want to compliment Sue McLaren talking about preventative health care versus emergency room health care and also the role of taxes. One last thing before I get going. It was mentioned that earlier there was a couple of articles from the Wall Street Journal on the Clinton health care plan, and I have one on the Romney plan. I'll leave those with you if you'd like. You can take a look at those. But having said that, I want to talk about three different kinds of health care. The first kind is the kind we have today. Generally, it's provided as a job benefit or it's purchased by an individual. This is great if you have a good job or you can afford insurance. This is bad if you lose your job or your job does not offer insurance. It's not portable. For the most part, for young people, they can't get another job or just move around quickly or easily because oftentimes they have to be concerned about their health care. It's also a problem for boomers. And for people like myself who are definitely in that boomer generation, you start thinking about health care when you want to make a job switch. Oftentimes, at our age, we start running into issues that, again, make it difficult to get insurance on our own. But the problem with this plan is that the costs of the uninsured are oftentimes passed along to those with insurance, who think they really don't pay the costs anyways, and so they pay no attention to it, when in reality it drives up the premiums. And ultimately, companies are the ones who really bear those costs. Pre-existing conditions and insurance affordability, aside from these other things, can prohibit job growth, entrepreneurism, and business investment. It works on some levels, but those are some of the downfalls. Socialized healthcare, if I could use that term, moves people to a single-payer type of system. This can include a state or nationalized system, or even a mandated corporate concept. This is great for individuals. It offers great portability. You don't have to worry about changing jobs, whether you're a Generation Xer, a millennialist, or a baby boomer as myself. But oftentimes, it can lead to some things that we maybe don't want. That is, that it removes the cost of those who pay for it from those who use it. And as we all know, if you don't pay for something, you're much more apt to use a great deal of it. Last year, my daughter got married and wanted me to pay for the wedding, which I did a great portion of. She started out wanting to spend $80 per plate on a caterer. I quickly came to this concept that if I removed the cost of who was paying for that caterer from her, I would quickly pay $80 a plate. And so what I did in that case was tell her what I would give her and told her I don't care if she spent all of it, none of it, or eloped. It was up to her. She spent $20 per plate because she had some skin in the game. This kind of socialized healthcare when forced upon companies in many different ways is a job killer. It prohibits job growth, entrepreneurism, and business investment. Costs can often be uncontrollable, and services can be poor. I think adopting this in Minnesota simply for adoption's sake may be a job killer. But there are others, and this is what I think Mr. Herstedt was talking about, some of these hybrid systems. And these are being tried in places like Denmark and Massachusetts. Basically, it builds upon the existing system of insuring people. It mixes private coverage and government-subsidized care for those who cannot get it. Individuals are mandated to have insurance, and when they cannot afford it, they're given a subsidy to buy it. Insurance companies are prohibited from not insuring anyone, and therefore their pools of risk are flattened out and rates come down due to competition. Because individuals, not companies, buy insurance, competition enters into both the sales of insurance and the delivery of health care. In a system like this, individuals receive tax breaks and health savings accounts are promoted. In this system, individuals can be rewarded for staying healthy, and we would no longer encourage the moral hazard of promoting inexpensive health care services that appear less costly while passing the bills along to someone else. Companies may well be able to pay more wages in this kind of a system. And better yet, a hybrid system that combines both subsidies for those who cannot afford health care and market-driven incentives may provide better access for the entire population of Minnesota while keeping our companies competitive and creating jobs. I think in conclusion, I'd like to say that mandating more of the same kinds of health care at the expense of taxpayers and companies may in fact be a job killer. Doing so will demand we pay more money to the government, leaving less money to individuals. It does not matter if you are an elected official or the fortunate recipient of a gold-plated insurance plan. You will always make better decisions and spend less when you're spending your own money. I hope we don't march down the road of simply having socialized medicine to have a medical plan in place. Rather, we should assure access to cost-effective and real health care to all citizens of Minnesota. I think we should free companies of being in the health care business and let them do what they do best while harnessing the power of the free market. Former president said, no community is better than the business community causes it to be. And I think in this case, we have to consider businesses and what they're doing for our economy, what they're doing to provide jobs. Again, I urge you to consider all those options when making some of these decisions, and I'll make the articles for you. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for leaving the articles. A comment or a question, maybe. I understand the way you dealt with your daughter's wedding. I think that was wise. It was something that she could choose how to deal with it, and that's appropriate. But I see, as one who, I try and take good care of my health. I had some back surgery a couple of times for things that I, genetically, I guess I couldn't avoid. But I see a whole lot of people with things like mental illness. And when you try and tell them, you know, it's going to cost you $10 to see the doctor, $10. They're kind of sick and they don't realize the nature of their illness. And so many times, even a small thing, a $3 copayment on a prescription for people is something that they decide they're going to do without. And in the end, we pay more. And I guess I wanted your comment on that. And also the fact that, you know, I think the job killer in our country is the fact that we're spending almost twice what the rest of the world is with worse health outcomes and a sicker population as well. But I guess I wanted your comments on the idea that in something, an extra thing that you can choose to buy or choose not to, like wedding reception, is one thing, but, you know, for people with mental health and other types of things, or just low income, however you structure the payment system, it often turns them away from the preventive care they need.
I don't disagree with you on either counts. Again, I mentioned that we mandate health care coverage for all. And again, when it comes to those who can't truly afford anything, special allowances would have to be made. And I think that there are those types of issues that we could deal with on a preventive scale rather than a reactionary scale. So I'm not disagreeing with you on those. I'm saying let's have a comprehensive discussion on health care.
Sure.
And I think that's the important thing. We have to discuss all the options. Thank you for your testimony. Jennifer Schultz. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for coming to Duluth. Again, my name is Jennifer Schultz. I'm a professor of economics at U of D, and I specialize in health economics and insurance. And I'm hoping my testimony will help you in your debate going forward with the various bills on
the list.
Much of the discussion, unfortunately, in healthcare reform has focused on reducing the amount we spend on healthcare, rather than trying to cover the uninsured. Buying clothes, cars, and televisions is seen as patriotic to keep the economy afloat. Yet spending on medical care is viewed as a cost and liability. Healthcare is not like other goods and services, with individuals paying out of pocket for what they need. By its nature, most health spending must be covered by insurance. The reason is simple. In any given year, most have small medical bills, while a few have very large bills. It is unpredictable. Health insurance protects us from this uncertainty and financial loss. Therefore, everyone should have coverage. We also should acknowledge that an affluent society like ours should devote more of its resources to the health of citizens, not less. There are basically two paths to take to cover the uninsured: public coverage or subsidies for private coverage. There are advantages and disadvantages with each, and how one weighs these really depends on one's point of view and beliefs. Regardless of which path is chosen, you and the public should be aware of five main points. One, the belief that the lack of competition under public coverage will lead to high prices and low quality is not necessarily true. We continue to experience rising costs and prices in the current system we have. While federal programs like Medicare have been successful in keeping administrative expenses low and providing quality care. But regardless, and this point was made earlier, regardless of which path we take, which path we choose, we need transparency of price and quality information from providers to make appropriate choices. Point two, covering the uninsured does not mean that quality will suffer. Unfortunately, conservatives tend to frame the debate as a trade-off between quality and coverage. Ensuring that everyone has coverage and access to care may actually improve the quality of care for all. Providers can divert resources from reimbursement efforts to providing patient care. Uncompensated care will be eliminated and administrative expenses will decline. Point three, the level of competition in insurance markets has been declining. Minnesota once had over 10 private health insurers and now has only 3 major players. Nationally, insurers are merging in a race to increase their bargaining power with providers. This is just shifting costs between patients, depending on their coverage, but not adding any value. And in many locations in Minnesota, some providers have only one private payer to negotiate with. This leaves them in a very precarious position when negotiating contracts. Point number four. Many supporters of free markets fail to mention that when there is imperfect and asymmetric information, as exists in healthcare, competition may not be the most efficient method to allocate resources. Point number five, and most importantly, free markets care not for fairness, but only for efficiency, which is the absence of waste. In general, we need to return to policies that combine profound respect for the virtues of free markets with profound concern for those the market leaves behind. Too often, the electorate is presented with a choice between policies of free market ideology that lack compassion and policies that are soft on economic principles but long on compassion. We need another choice, one with sound economic policies and compassion. Compassion in the sense that the poor are needier than the rich. The principle of efficiency should not be the single goal, and markets alone are not the only solution. I'm frustrated by the Americans' tolerance for inequalities in health, inequalities in access to medical care, inequalities in income and political power. But I truly believe many Minnesotans care about equality of access to medical care because suffering, pain, and uncertainty should not vary by one's ability to pay. Many of the uninsured have no voice in the political process and do not have the means to be socially active in protesting the injustice of having inadequate health care. Because the uninsured have many faces and it's a dynamic group with individuals shifting in and out of coverage, there is no core group of individuals to mobilize. Thus, those of us who are insured and those of us who are able can no longer be passive observers. We must use our voices to speak for those not represented. And many of them are not represented here. I don't hear from many people who are uninsured. Healthcare is really vital for equal opportunity. And this is what America is supposed to be, a place for equal opportunity. And hence, I think it's in our best interest of our state to care for all of our citizens. Minnesota was once a leader in health care reform, and I hope we can reinstate our role as a leader and become a model for national reform. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Can we get copies of your testimony? I particularly like the way you worded points 4 and 5.
We would like Vanny Hayden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And thank you for coming tonight to listen to what happens here in Duluth. I'm actually telling the story of a friend of mine, Tamika Robinson. She's unable to be here tonight because of sickness in her family. But what happened was she was uninsured and she started to go to the doctor with headaches. Eventually, they found tumors behind her eyes. This took like 6 months. And they shipped her down to Minneapolis, away from her family, or anybody she knew. She wasn't allowed to take anybody with her. At this point, she was blind. I can't imagine what that would be like, and I've tried a lot of times what that would be like, to be isolated from my family and everybody I knew to get treatment somewhere else. Now there's a question of her primary care physicians not caring for her because she went to Minneapolis to seek the coverage of the medical attention she needed. It's one thing or another, getting the appointments with the doctors, the transportation down there, not being able to take anybody with her. It's just been a real challenge. As much as I'd like to say the Lighthouse has stepped in, they have helped somewhat, but her blindness is so monumentally minimal that they don't even know about the kind of blindness she has. So now, for her to read or do anything, there's programs that could be made available to her through the computer, but they wanted to take the training in Minneapolis for 6 months. Now that's another, she won't even see her kids grow up. She's not being able to see now. She has had some shadows and things come back, but this at a time in a young woman's life where she's barely 30 years old, she's raising her children, and her husband's working 2 jobs, and he still can't afford insurance. It's horrendous. I have friends that can't get medication or dispose of their needles properly from insulin care. I've watched so many of them sick, in pain a lot. The hospital visits, you go, you're there for hours. Sometimes I feel that not only is it a barrier because of poverty, but because of prejudice. I've seen it almost every time I've been in hospitals, preference, quality of care. I believe that at this point, we're only managing people's deaths. We're not managing health care. They're saying, okay, the change is coming, the change is coming. More and more, my friends are dying. their quality of life isn't half what it should be or what they're even entitled to. And then the obstacles just to overcome to get to the people you need to get the care, it's insufferable. They tell you that there's something there for you, then you go there and they say, oh no, we're out of money. Or no, you can't go here, or you can't go there. It's managed death care, as far as I'm concerned. I've had some mental health problems myself, and I thought I wouldn't make it because in the simple place, it took me almost a year to get an appointment once I was came out of recovery for alcoholism and was diagnosed bipolar. It took me almost a year just to get the appointment. That means I was on no meds that whole time, which just fed into the alcohol rebound of self-medicating. So there for myself, I just think, if nobody's going to say what's going on in their lives and you don't know, how can you fix it? And when you're in poverty, there's not a whole lot, especially with the heating oil and gas going up now, medication, copays, I'd rather be warm and hungry than full and full of medication and cold. I don't know what to do. I certainly don't know what to do about this one, so with me paying an eating bill. So that's probably what I have to say.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and again, your comments about mental health, trying to wait a year to get an appointment. We do, our mental health care is seriously lacking, not because we don't have good people to provide the care, but because it's not reimbursed, it's not covered by people, and as you pointed out, that does lead to chemical use where people self-medicate. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Vicki Sandville. In order to save time between presenters, because we still have about seven or so more, Barbara Sleitenberger will be the next person. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much for being here. My name is Vicki Sandville. I live here in Duluth. I'm on the board of the Minnesota Citizens Federation Northeast. I'm here to give you our organization's views, plus that of our statewide organization, the Greater Minnesota Healthcare Coalition, GMHCC. Together, we represent over 3,000 members. We have offices in Duluth, St. Cloud, and more. There are a number of stories this evening about severe problems in affording healthcare. Please remember, each story represents tens of thousands more Minnesotans who are not here today. It's clear we are in an overwhelming health care crisis. In Minnesota, we're doing much better than the rest of the country, but that is still not saying very much. Instead of adding to details and statistics of individual problems, I want to talk about causes and solutions. First, I want to mention some current ideas which are not solutions, even though they are in vogue. One popular idea in the Massachusetts plan, which has been referred to earlier, and also the Healthy Minnesota plan, is to require everyone to buy insurance policies, but give some extra public subsidies to make it more affordable. This idea cannot work. That's because it perpetuates the huge administrative waste of multiple private insurance policies. The only way to make it somewhat affordable is to either have minimal policies, which are essentially catastrophic, or else pay out enormous subsidies that would bankrupt the state budget. I would also like to add that many people are not capable of securing their own policies. Other so-called reforms include report cards and pay-for-performance for doctors and electronic medical records. Report cards are based on a false premise, which is that many doctors have the power to change their patients' behavior, but are not doing so. And they would suddenly start and be successful at it if their financial rewards depended on it. Electronic medical records might increase efficiency to a degree, but they are extremely expensive and not likely to save much money, if any. Disease management is another area which does not have strong, consistent evidence of saving money overall. Something that does show a clear improvement is county-run administration of the state's health care program. The county-based systems have half the administrative expense of the private HMOs. I'd like to repeat that. Half the administrative expense of the private HMOs. They pay dentists better and therefore have better access to dentists. And they create positive, cooperative relationships with the healthcare providers instead of adversarial attitudes that can often come from HMOs. To highlight this, our organization is hosting a public forum on county-based purchasing here in Duluth, October 17th, 3 to 5 at the Labor Temple. In other words, health insurance coverage belongs in the public sector, not in the hands of private companies. Minnesota's private HMOs are nonprofit in name only and do not live up to their public purpose mission. The insurance industry in general has abandoned its original mission and only wants to insure those it knows it will make money off of. The sooner the legislature realizes that, the sooner we can create an efficient public system that meets the needs of the people. I'm sure many in the legislature understand what's going on, but they've got to be willing to take some risk and make some changes.
Thank you very much. Barbara Slatenberger, and I'm going to ask people to try a little more aggressively. We're going to ask people to be brief because we still have another number of people. We're not going to quite get everybody through if we don't. Ms. Slatenberger, welcome to the committee.
First of all, it's Flash for
me. Oh, I'm sorry, I have a wrong.
That's okay.
Wrong spelling. Welcome, and please just go ahead.
I'm not used to this type of speaking, but when I heard about you being here today, I definitely wanted to be able to present my problem. I retired in 91 from the federal government, and I've been struggling ever since to try to survive, and it's keeping on going downhill. As for preventive medicine, 3 and 4 years ago, my eye doctor seen diabetes in my eyes when I had my eyes examined and sent me to my doctor at Duluth Clinic. And they did further tests and said, oh, you've got no diabetes. This spring, I was diagnosed with diabetes, and I'm on insulin and pills already. I can't afford the strips. I can't afford all the different things that comes with it. I was living in a high rise here in Duluth for seniors. It wasn't for seniors. It was completely incapable of making us a home. We weren't allowed to have air conditioners in the hot summer put in the windows, but they could air condition the manager and the Bowman offices. they're not allowed to have the heat turned on until October 15th. Last week was cold as could be. I don't know who's overseeing some of this stuff. Now I'm fighting with this diabetes. I had to move to get out of that place. I lost my Section 8, and they aren't putting even people on the waiting list. So I'm paying $800 a month for my rent. I'm paying $300 for Blue Cross and Medicare. I don't get decent care because the insurance company tells the doctors what they can write for me and what they can't. I'm paying high copays with mail order and drugstore. And so my drug coverage or my medical coverage is over $300 a month. I don't have anything to live on. And I gotta go out and get a job, and I can't hardly stay awake for 4 hours at a time without taking a nap. I went to mental health, and I've got mental health problems. But now they can't see me anymore, and I don't get the right reimbursements for them. The whole thing is nuts with these insurance companies going, being a Medigap or Medicare. Medicare sets the standards, which is low as could be. And then they pay half, and the insurance company pays the other half, and I get stuck with a bunch of bills because they won't even allow them to pay some of them. I have bowel problems. I'm getting them taken care of at the health access office here in town, but it's taken me a year. 2 years ago, I had EPD, Employee Persons with Disability, MA, and I had to go 2 hour drive to Deerwood to get dental care. Now, I don't have anything with Blue Cross. I used to, when I was working, I had eye care and dental care. I don't have any of those things with Blue Cross anymore from the federal government insurance. With diabetes, I've had to have several changes of glasses since March. They charge me $350 just for the lenses. I use my old frames. I don't understand where all this is going. And they don't cover nothing. I can't make it anymore. I know they would like to see us disappear and go dig our own hole and crawl in it, but I'm a little ornerier than that. But it's coming close. That's all I want to say. I'm not a speaker, but I'll tell you, it's a hell of a place to retire.
Well, thank you. Your testimony is powerful, even if you're not used to doing that. Thank you very much. Angie Miller.
Single and four families.
So that's a huge increase. We had budgeted 15% and it's 37%. So now we're looking for, you know, a different plan, obviously. So either we have to cut program money, you know, for the low-income people that we serve, we have to cut programs, or we have to pass on a huge amount to the employees, and many of whom are not paid enough to absorb the big deductible, the high co-pays, and then the increase in the premiums. So that's one problem as a small nonprofit employer that we're faced with the healthcare crisis. And the other is, in my work as a housing counselor, I help people who are trying to become first-time home buyers. And so I see maybe 75 to 100 credit reports every year. And just like the person was talking about earlier, a medical debt on your credit history can be a barrier in your life for a very long time. It can keep you from getting a mortgage. It can put you into a high-interest credit card rate because you have a low credit score. You end up with a car loan that's 22% interest, all because you have a low credit score, in some cases due partly or largely to a medical debt in collections on your credit report. And one point is I have found in my experience that the hospitals are fairly quick to turn people over to collections. And the collection agencies, they do not operate in the same wonderful values and mission of the big hospitals. They have their own, you know, agenda, and that's collect the money no matter what. And so collection agencies for medical debts are hounding people mercilessly. And actually, probably most of you are aware, but there have been studies on people who file for bankruptcy, and over half of them, a part of it is medical debt. And it's a huge problem. So it's not just that people can't get access to health care, which is bad enough. It's also that, you know, it's responsible for people filing bankruptcies and then, you know, being hounded by collectors and then having these low credit scores. So it's kind of a, you know, comprehensive problem. And it prevents people from moving ahead and becoming first-time home buyers in addition to causing their debt. So I appreciate that you're here, and I'm glad that you're willing to work on this issue. And I really appreciate personally the fact that you extended coverage to young people who are not full-time students. I think that's going to be a huge benefit. So thank you for that step.
Thank you very much, Senator Lori.
Thank you, Angie, for the testimony. Also, I wanted to add, I was wondering if somebody was going to cite that statistic about over 50% of bankruptcies are driven, at least partially, by medical debt. And a follow-up to that is that 75% of those bankruptcies are people who had insurance when they incurred their medical debt. And that's
which points startling. Out that it's the health care crisis was one for low-income people, but now most of middle America is one illness away from bankruptcy.
I hit that out-of-pocket maximum, I think it was like April 10th, of $4,000 for my family. And I have very expensive insurance from my employer, and I, you know, still was hit with a large bill that I'm still paying on.
Thank you very much. Susan Jordan.
Struggling with health care.
trying to figure out how not only to get to the health care. I heard earlier people who need to go to the cities, navigating the system of the Minnesota Net transportation is very, very difficult. And you have to have the cooperation of your financial worker. If you have a financial worker who's having a bad day or doesn't like you, you could really be out of luck. And it happens every day. We see it every day. I tell you these things about myself so that you can see how and understand that my experiences and the things that I see every day are what a vast majority of Duluthians see, as well as, I think, Americans see in general. And I want to spend a moment to correct just a few misconceptions.
Please be brief because we still have about seven more people.
Okay. Many people have mentioned a lot of things, but I'll tell you a few things that people see as misconceptions. It's the uninsured's fault that they're not insured. 8 out of 10 uninsured people come from working families. As we've heard here, most people who are working, that would include me, have a great job, love my job. I also have a husband who has chronic congestive heart failure. He's had 3 massive strokes, and I have 2 disabled children, or 2 children with special needs. My life is really controlled by healthcare and what it costs. And I have great insurance. It's about to get really bad due to the retiree healthcare problem in Duluth, which would be a great thing for you to look into. They've raised the water rates, which makes it harder for us here, and the heat, which makes it harder for us here in Duluth, where it's very cold, as well as now they're forcing all city employees to take the worst program with the highest deductible. For my family, it's thousands and thousands of dollars. I will have to sell my house. I already almost lost it once. I got it back. I'm going to have to sell it because of what's happening to our insurance. And I have a good job. What happens to the other people? One of the biggest things that I want you to hear. Universal health care, single payer compensation, result in a number of moral, economic, and cultural benefits. It's not a welfare policy for the uninsured. It's really an investment in our community, in the country. We make people healthy. Department of Urban Renewal has just come out with a report through HUD saying that education, employment, everything is connected to health care. If we invest in health care and invest in the people in this community and communities across the country, we invest in the whole country. We are wasting money by not having single payer health care, universal system. And we're hurting our country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Carolee Isbell. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, thank you very much for this opportunity to talk. You know, I had thought a few things, but I wanted to start out with something on a very personal note. You had mentioned bankruptcy and talking about bankruptcy and healthcare costs. And right now, I have a very close family member who has to file bankruptcy. They had insurance. After hospitalization, the insurance deemed it was a pre-existing condition, and then did not cover the hospital stay. And they incurred just a ton of debt, and so are now facing bankruptcy. And I think that is an issue that needs to be addressed, is the pre-existing condition clauses in a lot of insurance that insurance companies have. So my name is Carolee Isbell, and I work with at-risk homeless and low-income youth through Lifehouse. I have a few things, but I want to be really brief. First off, I wanted to address mental health and mental health barriers that a lot of people have. It's really easy to say that people just need to get health insurance or to take care of those issues. When you have mental health barriers, that can be very, very difficult. One thing that comes up quite often, and I'll talk about medical assistance, is that for medical assistance, you need to renew. Quite often, people will qualify for that care and will access it for a while, but will fall off medical assistance because especially the youth that I work with are homeless or high risk or have other mental health issues, so that they don't even have an address where they can receive these forms from. So what happens is they fall off medical assistance, and then when they end up going in for medical care, they don't have any coverage. So they might go to the ER or urgent care. They are, it's just treat and street. There's very little follow-up. And I'll share a story of a young father I worked with who came in, had very bad teeth problems. He was on medical assistance, so I helped him look into dental care, found out that he was not covered any longer. There was a huge waiting list for dental care and to get back on there, and he ended up in the emergency room, again, like the person who's talking to the house. I also want to speak, I'm a doula. So I am maternity. Healthcare costs are huge in this country, and a doula helps, can provide all sorts of benefits. We provide emotional, physical, and informational support throughout the childbearing year. Currently, doulas are not covered by insurance companies or medical assistance, and I think that that needs to change. There has been a lot of talk, and I appreciate Senator Pregner's support during the last session on that bill. But doulas can help. Lots of benefits have been shown, including shortening labor, decreasing high-cost medical interventions, and increasing satisfaction with the birth, also increasing breastfeeding, bonding, and parenting skills. And all of these things in the long run can decrease not only costs, but rates of postpartum depression and other issues that we have. Often as well, women who benefit the most from doula support are those who have the least access to it because of lack of knowledge and lack of money. And I think that those two things are things that we could easily fix. And I also prepared something that we can take a look at.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you. And quick question about the family member, I don't want to get into the personal details, but you said it was a pre-existing condition. They had gotten the treatment, and then the insurance company said it wasn't covered because it was some sort of pre-existing condition?
Correct. Yes.
You know, when you were talking about some of the young people you work with and how they qualify for medical assistance, but because they got to reapply so often and they lose it because they're homeless and they don't get the thing, the forms in the mail, I think that gets back to the point when the discussion earlier about whether we make sure we subsidize people's health care and we do that. That doesn't fix the problem in a case like that because they just don't even, they're not even able to apply for it. I kind of think we should see health care the way we see other services everybody needs, police and fire. When you call the police to your house because of a burglary, they don't call and check and say, well, what's your insurance? How are you going to pay for this? It's something everybody needs and we should provide it.
And regarding mental health, the waiting lists are incredibly long to get on that. And the other thing is that very few you need a diagnostic to receive a lot of mental health services. And to get on there, you need some sort of insurance, but you need mental health help to get that insurance. So sometimes that can be very, very difficult. And the other thing is the new, to apply for MA, you need a birth certificate. And that can be very, very difficult right now when you live out of state or you're born out of state. Or even getting the money to get the birth certificate can be very difficult. So there are all these barriers that we're putting up.
And does Lifehouse work with mentally ill young people or homeless young people, which obviously often?
I think they go hand in hand.
Yes.
Adopted, but we work with low-income, at-risk, and homeless youth.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cynthia Donnert. And
and I think we're going to go till maybe if committee members can go to 7:45. If that's okay. I'd like to get through the list if we can. We're close. But
thank you very much. My name is Cynthia Donner. I'm the executive director for a very small grassroots nonprofit called East Hillside Patch in Duluth. We started dealing with people and their experiences with the healthcare system just over 3 years ago, not because we wanted to, because our constituents were struggling even more so, and that has not stopped. More and more people are coming together with us, sharing their stories. To cut to the chase, a lot of what we've done is investigate with people to find out their experiences, starting at the local level, and with the public systems and the private sector as well. So we're dealing with people who've been uninsured and underinsured. I'm going to leave with you tonight some surveys we completed with the help of some nursing students from the College of St. Scholastica during the first quarter of this year. Out of 175 people surveyed, at least half of those said they needed help getting medical or dental care or resources due to the lack of or limitations in insurance. 67 of those 107 said they've been confused about or frustrated with healthcare systems or institutions, bills, referrals, different opinions, access, denied insurance claims, and lack of help, and so forth. I'm going to leave you the rest of the results for you to look at, but I just want to say that all the people we're dealing with, particularly we've been focused these last 3 years on low and moderate income folks. These are people who really want preventative services. They really want resources to manage wellness or other conditions before they get really bad. They simply don't have access to services, the public health programs, the co-pays. People just can't manage it. We've heard other stories here tonight. One piece I want to make, though, because so many people are struggling with this issue, is affordable prescription drugs. We've got to deal with this together. You folks, citizens, these folks are way out of control, and they're driving a lot of our costs. And as a state, we need to deal with this. I'm just appalled every time I turn the television and see all the ads. And yet, still, we can't get a local PSA about some of the resources trying to help people around here. But I want to point out, there aren't enough resources. What we've learned from people is that the current resources are so limited that they can't possibly meet the needs of people outside of very narrowly defined eligibility criteria. The bureaucratic nature of current healthcare organizations, driven by the private model, makes it impossible for all potentially eligible persons to find out even about the resources that they may that may be able to help them. And thirdly, under the current climate of all this eligibility criteria and multi-level authorizations and most frequently denials, the process of accessing the potential resources entails mounds of paperwork and professionals that are not usually sensitive to the realities of people who at the same time are struggling with debilitating health conditions. We have horror stories after horror stories about that one. I just want to point out that as we've tried to deal with this current healthcare system that is nothing but a matrix of policies carried out by administrative procedures and gatekeepers that generate multiple barriers to healthcare resources, the only people, the only entities reaping benefits are the private corporations, HMOs, drug companies. We consider them to be predatory liars and deniers in terms of the whole pool of healthcare resources, and we have to tackle this. So I want to thank you for your current bill, and we and our constituents are happy to see that you removed the HMOs from private companies. We want to see move to a single-payer system operated by government so there can be accountability to the rest of us public citizens, and I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I think when you talked about all the paperwork, they now, the estimates are that over 30 cents on every dollar we spend on healthcare here is going to, in effect, the paperwork. Senator, so on.
Cindy, one of the things that we did pass this year, though, was to decrease the application costs for the public program. So the new forms, we're trying to get them reduced to, I think, 4 pages is what we expect.
But if we can transfer that even to some of our local systems or some of the smaller private programs,
if we pass a bill like the reform, I'd like to see happen. We wouldn't have application forms if you're Minnesotan, you're covered.
That's what we
save a lot of time and money. Joan Johnson.
Thank you.
close to the microphone.
Yeah, I'm a little rocked. But I've had a health condition for 30 years. I was poisoned by chemicals. And I think that, in my view of this whole system, nothing has ever really worked for me, because this kind of illness is not acceptable in our mainstream medical society. Yet I got Medicare based on my illness, and they recognize chemicals and sensitivities, but they don't pay for it. So as a single mother that worked and worked and worked to make a go of it, and I worked for 11 years before I was diagnosed, my child ended up taking care of himself, and I lay in bed dying. And so I didn't have the money to pay out of pocket to get alternative health care, because hospitalization and drugs don't help me. I needed nutrition and detoxification procedures and lots and lots of care, which I couldn't receive. So I basically lay home dying for like 10 years until I finally was able to get my... I went through bankruptcy. Now I've worked through most of my pension. And I'm still not able to even get an ultrasound covered with the doctors that I see. I spent $30,000 out of state in 2005 just to see some specialists, because I had never been able to see them. And they sent me to the hospital to try and figure out why my kidneys weren't working. And they said, well, Medicare won't pay for you to have an ultrasound. And I'm like, I can't get a pap smear except like once a year, and I have a lot of endocrine system problems, and so I'm like paying for two health care policies, but they don't pay anything. And now I can't afford to pay for that. So I don't really need to have you know my story. What I think we need to look at is that people don't get sick because they got bit by a cancer bug. They got sick because they got affected by something in their food, their water, or their environment. And so many people are just, I guess it's kind of a blatant neglect in our society to really recognize a problem. We're going green, but we don't want to help our Gulf War veterans or our 9/11 people, which is basically the same problem. There's so many new immune system diseases that don't get coverage, like chronic fatigue and environmental illness and this type of thing. And most of these kind of immune system diseases, where your liver is overtaxed, you need nutritional care and all kinds of support all across the board, but nothing alternative is ever even considered to be covered. So I guess that's my viewpoint, is that I would like to see some kind of preventive care where you're allowed to see a nutritionist when your digestive system is so... in such dysfunction that you can't even digest your food. I couldn't take a pill to detoxify the chemicals that were in my body. So I know it's kind of a far cry when there's so many other illnesses out there being treated by drugs. And I see all these drug ads and I think, geez, I wonder if they ever tell these people why they got sick, or if ever people make the connection that if we all have to be responsible. We don't need perfect lawns, and we don't need every spider out of our house. And I have a special condition. I think it's considered special, but I have so much discrimination when I go to mainstream medicine that they try to say my illness is emotional because they can't diagnose it and can't treat it, and the drug doesn't pay. You know, the drug companies don't pay them to treat me. In fact, I had a dislocated knee, and I had a doctor in Duluth here tell me that maybe my condition was emotional. And I went to another doctor the next day, and he said, yeah, you have a dislocated kneecap. And this was at the Duluth Clinic. And so, I mean, I've run into it time and time again that people need to become more aware that there is other illnesses that are not, are not going to be buying into the massive overdose drug use in this country, which create a multitude of symptoms if you even watch TV. Well, if you take this drug, you might have kidney failure, and you might have this, and you might have that. I'm just here to say I'd like to just
just use this moment to say people need to realize what they're using in their homes, on their lawns, in their environment, that their children, now children, they say, by the age of 3, have more toxic chemicals in the body than we even as adults do because of what we've allowed our country to do to us. And that's all I really can say because I have never gotten anything covered in 30 years. So I don't really hold out a lot of hope for me, but I think as a society we need to look at that preventive health care. I haven't had dental care in 20 years except for one time I went for social services paid for some things. But when you're really, really sick, you don't have the energy to go out camping. And so I hope that in the end, someday, the insurance companies will be able to look at preventive care as a way to say, you know, down the road you might not need drugs if we help you today and give you the right things you need.
Thank you very much. One of your comments at the end, I think, was important one about how people, when they're sick and down and out, they don't really have the strength to advocate for themselves, and our system relies on people to be able to do that, to get the care they need. So,
right.
Well, thank you for your testimony.
Another thing was that I was so discriminated against that it became emotionally exhausted just to try and get help, you know, to go through the system and try and fill out the paperwork and then try and go through the spend downs and bring every receipt and try to justify what I needed as a medical expense. It was like, well, do you really think I'm just making this up so that I can get this care? And when I was a full working parent, you know, going along trying to make it in life, and all of a sudden people look at you and say, well, geez, you have a good life. You don't have to work. Like, I don't get these people. You know, there is a lot of discrimination with disability, I have to say. If you don't have something that they can see, like a broken arm or a broken leg or something, then it must be in your head. Well, people don't understand. And I've seen people with cancer go through the same process. They're just, you don't have the strength. So
thank you for your testimony. We're going to take about two more that we're not going to quite finish them all, but we'll cut it off then and ask that others would come up to us and talk individually because I would like to cut it off in 5 minutes. But Peg Anderson. And I'm sorry we're running out of time, but I think it's been a long hearing and you've all been patient and we can stay around and listen, but I think I'd like to call it to an end after one more. Go ahead, Ms.
Hello, I'm Peggy Anderson and I wear many hats, but I'm here for American Cancer as an ambassador and a CAN member. And I just want to say that American Cancer Society supports early detection, treatments, and resources for the cancer patient, and they have a new program called Access to Care, which they're going to be doing a lot more advertising with. But I've had some experiences myself. I run into women all the time in the community. Just last week, a lady called me and told me she had to spend down all of her earnings and sell her house, and she was living in a basement because of her cancer bills from the clinic. Another lady that I know went on 2 clinical trials and went from stage 1 to stage 4 cancer because she had $5,000 deductible health insurance. And so she made a choice, but the choice was the wrong choice. I've found that some patients have told me that doctors won't order tests when they find out what kind of insurance you have. Cancer should not be about losing everything. It should be about early detection, the correct tests, and the correct treatment, and having a positive outlook. We have 47 million uninsured in our country and millions of underinsured. 1 out of 5 have used up most of their savings and have cancer. 4 out of 5 skip their pills and treatments. The highest risk people are the underinsured that are likely to have advanced cancer. And it's often the Black, the low income, and the Hispanic populations. I know even as a retired teachers typically run out of health insurance in 4 years. I've been told city employees continue to have health insurance, even when, because it's a different system.
let's see what else I'm going to say here. I've been in the dentist office where the dentist has turned down people who need to have their teeth fixed. I know patients who have gone down to Mayo that need the treatment at Mayo because of a clinical trial or a special test, but test or protocol, and they can't afford to drive down there. So it shouldn't be about your insurance. It should be about the right choices and the correct tests and the correct treatments. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Dan Svensson.
Expect to have that program operational within a year. individual land use programs may be small and may look to be less important, but collectively these things will have a very positive impact on the community. And we think that other communities should be trying to do the same thing.
Thank you very much. Because of the time, I am going to cut this off and assure those, we had about four more who wanted to testify, and we'll stay around and take some of that. I did want to wrap up for just a second to say that I think Mr. Svensson's comment there about how, yes, while we wait for comprehensive health care reform, we do have to plug in little gaps. Anything we can do to help people now is important. But I also think we have to remember, just think about where we've gone to now, where we've slipped to, where it's just, we just take it as a given that some people are going to, people are going to struggle to get the care they need. The vision of people is, somebody mentioned earlier, prison inmates have medical care. Why can't the rest of us have the same medical care? And where you don't have to fight to do it and find out who can cover it, 29 different programs you try and plug people into. It's just a bizarre way to deal with people's health care. And of course, it ends up waiting until they're sick, until they need the most care. Very little of the prevention, very little of the public health. And I think whatever we do in designing healthcare reform, we have to make sure we're starting with the prevention, starting with the public education. And you start with the premise, if you need to see a doctor, you get the care you need. You don't start with the premise that, where are you going to pay for it? How are you going to pay for it? And it's an important issue to come up. I think it's the number one issue a lot of my colleagues who were just elected this year coming in and saying that was the number one issue they heard out campaigning. And I just want to assure you that we're hearing these comments. They're not pleasant to hear. I don't think there were any fun stories tonight, but it's very helpful to us, and I will assure you we'll bring them back. And I'm convinced that if this next year is not the year to do it, we're building public pressure because it's not something we should find acceptable in our society. And with that, unless any members of the committee wanted to make a last comment, I want to thank you all for coming and thank the members of the committee for coming. This is very helpful to us, and we'll keep your comments in mind. Thank you very much, and with that, the meeting is adjourned.